Our speaker is presently Albert Schweitzer, professor of the humanities at the City University of New York. He is also an expert on the FDR administration and chairman of the Roosevelt Centennial Committee. He has been awarded two Pulitzer Prizes for history and biography. He has written over 20 books and has received numerous grants and awards. Educated at Harvard and Cambridge universities, Dr. Schlesinger holds a number of honorary degrees from colleges and universities throughout the United States and Canada. It is a distinct pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. Arthur Schlesinger, Jr.
Thank you. Distinguished presidents, ex-presidents, ladies and gentlemen, friends of Dutchess Community College, it is a singular honor to take part in this 25th anniversary convocation and to join in the celebration of the first quarter century of this honorable institution. When this college was established in 1957, sponsored by the citizens of Dutchess County in cooperation with the State University of New York, it was an action undertaken in the oldest American tradition. For the American vision of itself, our national self-image has been of this great republic as a land of opportunity. America began as a place where those denied a fair chance in older societies, strangled by prescriptive inequalities, came to make their own way in life, to rise to their own level, to live not according to ordained concepts of status and privilege, but according to their own best talents, their character, and their ability. Our purpose has been not to guarantee equality of result, but to offer equality of opportunity. The land of opportunity is a hackneyed phrase, no doubt overstates the case, but everything in life is relative. And the point of American democracy, as great foreign observers like Tocqueville recognize, is that it abolished the feudal ideas of caste and order, of legalized and inherited inequality, and set itself up in business as offering everybody more or less an equal chance. This has been our tradition, exemplified here, and this 25th anniversary invites us to consider what is happening to the noble vision of America as the land of opportunity. For in this process of the equalization of opportunity, we have always believed from the first settlers on these rugged shores that education plays a central and indispensable role. Education is the basic means of equipping young men and women for the struggles of life, the means of developing talents, of liberating imaginations and energy. I'm familiar, of course, with the revisionist view held these days by left-wing American historians, the view that dismisses education in the United States as a system of social control designed to produce compliant and brainwashed operatives to do the dirty work of American capitalism. Education is indeed, among other things, a form of social control, though far less systematically and harshly so in the United States than in communist states like the Soviet Union. The fact that education indoctrinates people in the rules and values of the surrounding society is surely no blinding revelation. But to say that education is simply a system of social control is to see only half the story. Education, at the same time, is an agency of social emancipation. There is nothing more dangerous for an existing order than to teach people how to read. For there is never any telling how far that the subversive habit of reading may carry people before they are through. This is notably understood in communist countries, where the authorities are so afraid of promiscuous reading that they devote much time and energy to keeping dangerous books away from the young. I can understand why communists do this, because they believe in a regimented society. But I must confess that I shudder when I see people in the United States emulating the communist example, harassing schools and libraries to ban books that these zealots find distasteful, disturbing, or threatening. It is a free country, and no one is compelling them to read these books themselves, but it will be a free country no longer if they succeed in committing their communities or nation to the imbecile course of censorship and book burning. Let them not try to reshape the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave, on the horrid model of Soviet Russia. One obligation all those who believe in education must have is to oppose cultural vigilantism, for we will not remain the land of the free unless we act as the home of the brave. No, education is composed in unpredictable proportions of indoctrination and liberation. I've always thought that the power of teachers as indoctrinators is considerably overrated. My own experience after 40 years of teaching is that the typical American student, when you can manage to grab his attention, is notably independent and obstinate, and alas, not at all inclined to accept everything his professor tells him as the gospel. Parents, of course, are far more crucial in forming children's opinions than teachers. It has always seemed a little fair to blame the heresies and delinquencies of the young on the school rather than on the home, on teachers who have resistant children a few hours a day over a period of 8 or 9 months a year, rather than on parents who have had them full time since birth. If one of the points of education is preparation for life, then to deprive young people of the benefit of the clash of ideas and values that exists in the real world is to constrict and undermine the educational process, the process that has always been regarded as it was by those who established this institution as an essential part of the machinery of opportunity in America. The state university itself was founded in 1948 to meet the duty of opportunity. After the war, even with that great piece of legislation, the GI Bill of Rights, first great federal action in the way of providing access to higher education. Even after the GI Bill of Rights, only 1/4 of New York's high school graduates went on to college, and many of these, of course, went outside the state. Less than half the students in the top quarter of their high school class in New York State 35 years ago went on to college. And of course, minorities, minorities of sex or of color, had much less of a chance than white males. This was a situation that led to the establishment of an independent State University of New York and a new system of locally sponsored community colleges. The purpose was to make higher education available to every person in the state who was able and willing to work at educating himself or herself. Community college. When I was young, the term was junior college, in any event, two-year colleges, but the word shift from junior to community signalizes that special relationship to the community whose will and readiness to sponsor a college was, under the SUNY system, a necessary condition to its establishment. In the years since the Second World War, the rise of the community college has been a salient feature of American higher education. Between 1960 and 1980, the number of community colleges in the country nearly doubled, and today, more than half of the freshmen and sophomores in the country enrolled in institutions of higher education. More than half are enrolled in community colleges. The community college has become a vital part of the machinery of opportunity, whether leading on to four-year colleges or on to jobs. And in either case, acquainting students not only with technical and vocational skills, but with a sense of the great humane intellectual heritage of our civilization. At least, I trust and hope that this is the case. I know it's the case in Dutchess Community College, and all community colleges must remember that they have an obligation not only to equip young men and women for jobs, but an obligation to expose them to the great legacy of thought, belief, and action of our civilization. Nor is this to overlook the increasingly important contribution to the education of adults, especially of women whose children have grown and who have the desire, and heaven knows the right, to complete their own education, and who, in my experience, provide the best students around. The history of Dutchess Community College emphasizes another point. That is, because education is so central to the drama of opportunity, we have always believed in America that government has a fundamental role in the educational process. This has been true since the founding of the Republic and on the national as well as on the state and local levels. George Washington himself was a powerful advocate of the establishment of a national university, even leaving part of his estate in his will for the endowment of such an institution. John Quincy Adams, noting that the object of government was, as he said, the improvement of the condition of those who are parties to the social compact, Adams listed as first among the duties of government the support, as he said, of public institutions and seminaries of learning, institutions devoted to the acquisition of knowledge. Congress, Adams went on, had the constitutional power to enact laws promoting the cultivation and encouragement of the mechanic and of the elegant arts, the advancement of literature, and the progress of science. For Congress to refrain from exercising these powers for the benefit of the people, Adams said, would be to hide in the earth the talent committed to our charge, would be treachery to the most sacred of trusts. And it was Abraham Lincoln who signed the Morrill Act in 1862, offering the state's grants of public lands as endowments to aid in the establishment of agricultural and mechanical colleges, therefore launching our superb land-grant college system. Nor can one forget an institution nearly as important as our system of formal schooling, nearly as important to the opening of opportunity, and that is our public libraries. As Thomas Jefferson wrote James Madison 160 years ago, a library book is not then an article of mere consumption, but fairly of capital, and often in the case of professional men setting out in life, it is their only capital. Our history has been greatly shaped by men and women who read their way to knowledge, opportunity, and achievement in our public libraries. In 1875, we had only 188 public libraries. By 1900, during this great period of economic expansion, we had 5,000. What an opportunity our libraries have provided to thoughtful, earnest, ambitious people seeking better lives for themselves and their children. So one of the great American traditions exemplified in this state university, in this community college, has been this double belief in education as a mechanism of opportunity and in the obligation of government to sustain and cherish our system of education. If one were to submit the concept of America as a land of opportunity to economic analysis, education would figure in the account book as investment in human capital. I should add that though private institutions have played an essential role in the history of American education, government has played the largest role in the schooling of Americans and in equipping them to seize the opportunities of American life. Education has never been entrusted to the workings of the free market. No doubt ingenious entrepreneurs at one time or another have made money out of education, but it has never been the object of profit-making investment. Education has prospered in America because it is so self-evidently necessary to modern society that we have cheerfully taxed ourselves to give our children out of public funds a fair chance in a rough world, making the vision of America as a land of opportunity real. Education has been one of the foundation stones in this drama of opportunity. A second foundation stone necessary also to consider as we consider whether America will be a land of opportunity in the future as it has been in the past is the question of the underpinnings of our economic growth. For that growth through history has been an inexhaustible source of individual opportunity. Our economic development has rested on the creation of what economists used to call social overhead capital, or what it is now fashionable to call our economic infrastructure, the structure that provides the crucial foundations, the indispensable underpinnings of our economy, the elaboration of highways, riverways, canals, railroads, harbors, bridges that lay the essential basis for economic growth. Here, as in the field of education, individuals collaborated with government to put down the foundations for national growth and opportunity. For that growth, contrary to the current mythology, was not the spontaneous result of unfettered private enterprise. The great prophet of economic growth in the early republic was Alexander Hamilton, who believed in the dynamics of individual acquisition, but only if tempered by a measure of public direction and control. His countryman, Hamilton wrote, had a certain fermentation of mind, a certain activity of speculation and enterprise, which if properly directed may be subservient to useful purposes, but which if left entirely to itself may be attended with pernicious effects. And so in the great days, we laid the foundations of our industrial growth by creating the America infrastructure in the years before the Civil War, and a great contributor of capital and energy to this came from our state government. Some states, notably Pennsylvania and Virginia, had systems of mixed enterprise in which state governments bought shares in private corporations and placed state representatives on boards of directors. Of this 9,000 miles of southern railroads built by 1860, 70% of the capital came from public sources. Corporation itself came initially into use as an instrument of state activity, as a means by which the Commonwealth could direct the allocation of private economic resources. Stipulations in these early charters assured detailed legislative oversight of the ensuing activity. A number of states undertook direct public projects, of which New York's Erie Canal, publicly owned and publicly operated, was only the most celebrated. I invoke this history only in part because the invocation of history is the occupational temptation of historians. I invoke it primarily because history is the best of all antidotes to myth, and because myth, however pleasing as an object of idle contemplation, can be a most misleading guide to future action. The particular myth I have in mind is a notion sedulously propagated in recent times that America as a land of opportunity was the creation of an unassisted and unregulated free market, as if our mighty economy had sprung by immaculate conception from the loins of Adam Smith. Truth, as usual, is rather more complicated. America has been a land of opportunity because of the abundance of natural resources that surrounded our forefathers and invited them to settle and develop this verdant wilderness. A wide ocean insulated the new republic from foreign wars. Capital, technology, and skill flowed in from more developed countries through immigration and investment. And of course, a most decisive factor lay in the character of America's population and in the ideas and institutions that this population brought with them and cunningly adapted to the American circumstance. Against this propitious, favoring background, Americans secured their land of opportunity not through the blind workings of the market, but through wise public policy, assuring a mix of public and private initiatives. America has been a land of opportunity because from the start it has favored a policy of serious and systematic investment in human capital, especially through our education, our system of schools and libraries. It has been a land of opportunity because it has used public as well as private capital to build the infrastructure on which our economic growth rests. And it has been a land of opportunity insofar as it has rejected the ethos of unbridled greed, insofar as it has followed the precepts of Alexander Hamilton and subjected the activity of speculation and enterprise to proper public direction. Now, this historical recital may surprise some because it does depart a little from current preconceptions. We are these days, at least it would appear to this historian, in the midst of a counter-revolution against a good deal of American history. The philosophy presently in control in Washington rests on two basic propositions. The first is that government is the root of all evil. As President Reagan said in his inaugural address, government is not the solution to our problem, government is the problem. And the second is that once, in the current cliche, we get government off our backs, our problems will solve themselves. There are, of course, reasons for this counter-revolution. There has been a widespread impression that government has become too intrusive, too arbitrary, too remote, too inefficient. Part of this had its validity. And there is, in addition, a tendency to take out on government a lot of the other frustrations of life. In any event, a lot of Americans evidently decided that the time had come to roll government back, to diminish deliberately and systematically the role of government in the national life. In this spirit, the new administration has embarked on a policy of shrinking the functions of government. We have reduced federal support for education, federal support for students, for libraries, for the arts and humanities, for research and development in science and technology, for job training, for families with dependent children, as well as for cities, for mass transit, for food stamps, for housing, for nutrition, for civil rights enforcement, for Medicaid, indeed for everything except the Pentagon, whose insatiable appetite appears to grow with the eating. At the same time, we have reduced taxes for the rich, the whole theory of supply-side economics being that only the rich will spend their money in a way that will benefit the economy as a whole. The new policy, in short, is to cut taxes for the rich and social programs for the poor. The effect of these changes is already evident, and the cumulative effect, I would suggest, may well be to undermine the old dream of America as a land of opportunity. Federal policies have already materially reduced the access to higher education for students from poor families. When these policies of retrenchment have been imitated on the state level, they have reduced the funds available for higher education in our state institution. The administration's recent proposal that we should give tax credits to parents who send their children to private schools constitutes a blow at our whole system of public education. Far from cutting back in our national investment in people, we will need in this high technology age more sophisticated and specialized training than ever before for the baffling new world of computers, electronic data banks, lasers, satellites, and robots. To reduce our investment in education is to court disaster in the electronic age. You can be sure that Japan, West Germany, and the Soviet Union are not making that mistake. We should return to the standard that no qualified student in this land of ours should be barred from attending college for lack of ability to pay. Our public libraries, along the escalators of opportunity for the underprivileged of our land, are also in serious trouble. library system has experienced drastic reduction in hours, acquisitions, and services. In great cities, branches are closed down or open for only a few hours a week. The situation of our libraries today is worse than it was in the Great Depression. During the Depression, the best of all our public libraries, the New York Public Library, was open 79 hours a week. Today, it can stay open only 40 hours a week, half as much. Library branches, which during the Depression were open 6 days and four nights a week, are now open 3 to 4 days and one night a week. The Boston Public Library managed to stay open all weekends during the Depression. It's closed now. Across the land, community libraries kept open during the Depression are shutting their doors. One reason for this is that the nation had a different set of values during the Depression. And that, I might add, is probably one reason why we got out of the Depression. This crisis in the educational process coincides with a crisis in the condition of the infrastructure across the country. Highways, waterways, airports, bridges, sewers, water systems, water supply systems, harbors, schools, firehouses, jails, parks, tunnels, dams, railroads are crumbling away. Two out of every five bridges in this country need repair and replacement. As a number of magazines are beginning to point out, America is in decay. A good part of this infrastructure is half a century old, having been built, and built well, during the New Deal by the WPA, the PWA, the CCC, the RFC, and so on. And one thing is clear, that this infrastructure will never be rebuilt or replaced by private initiative, by the unregulated market, any more than the market built it in the first place. If we are going to establish the conditions for industrial revival and recover our ability to compete in world markets, it can only be done by public authorities taking the lead in rebuilding our nation. America's in decay, and we are confronting this fundamental problem in a state of national ignorance and governmental indifference. We have no real inventory and assessment of the condition of the nation's public facilities. We do know that in constant dollars, our national investment in public capital has declined 30% between 1965 and 1980. We urgently require a new approach to the restoration of the crucial underpinnings of our economy. New public capital investment strategies, priorities, and I would add a national capital budget that would separate investment in fixed public capital from current operating expenditures. In the short run, why not take our 10 million unemployed, as Franklin Roosevelt did half a century ago, and set them to the task of rebuilding the nation? This is what Senator Kennedy recently proposed. We clearly have, he said, the work and the manpower, people who desperately need the jobs. Our task is to put those two things together. Let us take people off the welfare rolls and put them back on payrolls, and at the same time rehabilitate our dams, bridges, water systems, sewage systems, rangeland conservation, harbor improvement, parks and playgrounds, and so on. Needless to say, this proposal was opposed by the administration and voted down in the Senate on September 29th by a vote of 60 to 37. The decline of access to higher education, the decline of investment in infrastructure are grave blows at the old idea of America as a land of opportunity. For the attack on public programs and public services cannot help being socially discriminatory, helping one class, the rich, hurting another, the poor. Public services matter not to the rich, but to the poor. The rich have limousines. The poor must rely on buses and subways. The rich send their children to private schools. The poor have no alternative but public education. Occupational safety and health regulation protect poor men in factories, not rich men in offices. The rich buy their books and pictures. The poor need public libraries and public museums. The rich have estates. The poor depend on public playgrounds, public swimming pools, public parks. The policy of cutting taxes for the rich and social programs for the rest may have some higher justification, but it is idle to suppose that it will not bring suffering to those living on the edge of survival in our land and restrict opportunity for many others. Last year in 1981, 2.2 million people entered the ranks of those classified by the government itself as poor. 4 million more are expected to join them this year, which will mean there are 35 million Americans officially classified as living in poverty. There may be an argument for purification through suffering. There is something really distasteful, however, when rich people call for purification through the suffering of poor people. Of course, the rich assure us that economic insecurity is the great spur, the great stimulus to economic accomplishment, and that economic security saps self-reliance and initiative. Yet the proposition that economic security saps initiative is one the rich apply to the poor, but not to themselves. If they really believe their guff about the bracing effects of economic insecurity, they would favor 100% inheritance tax so that their own children would not be denied this great moral benefit. Instead, the Reagan administration tax law cuts federal inheritance taxes in half, raising the exemption to $600,000 by 1985, all this enabling wealthy people to make sure that their children are going to be as economically secure as they are, thereby strengthening the barriers of class in this country and undermining the dream of equal opportunity for all children, whatever the accidents of birth. But as that great social philosopher Doonesbury has judiciously said, no one suffers but the poor, and they're used to it. I would suggest that present policies constitute a rejection of the traditional American practice of public investment in human capital and in infrastructure, and that if pursued much further, these policies will jeopardize our whole theory of the United States as an opportunity society. The doors of opportunity opened in years past by the intervention of government are being slammed shut in the faces of the poor and of the lower ranks of the middle class all across our country. These policies are not changed. The withdrawal of public concern, the class effects of the attacks on public services must cause the poor and powerless in our midst to lose faith in the justice of the social order. To put it bluntly, the present policies are well on the way to persuading the poor that they are victims of a class war directed against them by the economic establishment. Karl Marx predicted long ago that capitalism would be destroyed by its own contradictions, and especially by a class war between the rich and the poor. Capitalism has not triumphed over such dismal prophecies by loyalty to the old laissez-faire gospel of every man for himself in a free market and the devil take the hindmost. Capitalism has survived because of a continuing and remarkably successful effort to soften the hard edges of the economic system, to humanize the industrial order, to combine individual opportunity with social responsibility. It has survived because of a long campaign, organized, mounted, and pressed, it must be said, by the liberals, a campaign to reduce the suffering and thereby the resentment, the bitterness, the rebelliousness of those to whom the accidents of birth deny an equal chance. Marx was sure that class warfare would destroy capitalism. What he failed to foresee was precisely the ability of modern democratic society to develop a sense of social responsibility that would give the poor access to education, to libraries, and to a decent chance in the economy. Those who would now have us abandon social responsibility in the name of unbridled individualism are doing Karl Marx's work for him, and it may well be more effectively than a squalid host of communist parties has been able to do. It is hard to imagine a more potent incentive to revolution than a class war pursued by the economic establishment against the poor and powerless. Social responsibility is indispensable to the preservation of a free political order. This is not, I think, just the talk of bleeding heart liberalism. It is the imperative prescription of a wise conservatism. We are, I fear, involved in a dangerous experiment, a dangerous reversal of the historic traditions of our country, a mistaken and perilous effort to convert a land of opportunity into a class society. Every blow struck against public education, against public libraries, against equal rights to minorities, is a blow against America as a land of opportunity, a blow against democracy itself. This is not too late to get back to our historic track. The year 1982 marks, among other things, as you well know here in Dutchess County, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was a varied man, and he left a varied legacy. We must never forget one of his most vital remarks in his second inaugural, 1937. The test of our progress, FDR said, the test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. This is not only the test of our progress, it is the test of our humanity, of our wisdom, and of the quality of our civilization. As we understand the importance of education as the key to equal opportunity, as a means of enabling those who have too little to help themselves, then we can look forward with confidence to another quarter century of growth and achievement for the State University of New York, and most of all, for Dutchess Community College. Thank you very much.